I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. This is true. One-third of adults in the United States are obese, many more are overweight, and Americans spend tens of billions of dollars every year on weight loss programs and products. There are, though, some enduring untruths about how to lose weight that have been touted in the media and in the scientific literature, even though they're not based on good scientific evidence. At least that's the finding of a recent article titled Myths, Presumptions, and Facts About Obesity, published in the New England Journal of Medicine. Among those myths in the journal, small lifestyle changes can have a dramatic impact on your weight. PE classes in schools can prevent or reduce childhood obesity. Breastfed children are less likely to become obese than bottle-fed children. So today on Radio Times, what do we really know about weight gain and weight loss? And we have two guests who have joined us here in our Philadelphia studios. David Sarwar is a professor of psychology in psychiatry and surgery at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me back, Marty.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Stella Volpe. She's a nutritionist, exercise physiologist, professor, and chair of the Department of Nutrition Science at Drexel University, and she serves on the President's Council on Fitness, Sports, and Nutrition Science Board. And Stella Volpe, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
David, how should we understand what this article in the New England Journal of Medicine is telling us?
So I've read it a few times since it's come out, and I'm still not entirely sure what to make of it. On the one hand, what I'm reading is that they're trying to communicate to all of us the need for well-designed research studies to investigate these questions. But unfortunately, I think what's become the scroll on the bottom of you know, the CNNs of the world has been that these strategies simply do not work. And I think really the paper's telling us we're not sure if they work, and that some of these recommendations are going out into to day-to-day practice, and people are assuming that they do. So you started the show by talking about that small changes make a dramatic difference.
Yes.
And I would say you're right. Small changes don't make a dramatic difference, but they can make a small difference. And in our toxic environment now, we need all the small changes that we can get as a society to really push back against the obesity problem.
But do you think it's the problem with the article or the problem about how the press covers an article like this?
Well, a little bit of both. I mean, it's a bit of an egghead research-based article saying that we need to study these things. And, you know, and David Allison, who's one of the authors of it, talked about, well, we need a randomized controlled trial that puts thousands of people on a scale first thing in the morning, and they either weigh themselves once a day or once a week, and we see if there's a difference. And while I think there's a lot of validity in that question, I could also see senators and congressmen saying, wait a minute, we're spending millions of dollars on the NIH budget right now to investigate whether it makes more sense for people to be on the scale every morning or once a week, when in fact we know that being on the scale at all is a good thing.
Well, let me turn to you, Stella Volpe. We're talking about the problems of health and the millions of overweight Americans. I mean, it seems to me we must know something at this point about why people are overweight and some of the basics about how to deal with that issue.
Sure. Obesity and overweight is a complicated issue, as David would agree. So many things have led to this, Marty, including the fact that we have become more sedentary, portion sizes have increased dramatically. And those two together, the lifestyle of diet and exercise, are the two main components that have led to obesity in the United States in all ages. But what we do know that certain number of minutes of exercise, like 300 minutes or more per day, based on research.
300 minutes
per week. Pardon
Thank you
me.
Very much.
Thank you.
I was thinking, oh my gosh, I got to get out of here and go running.
Yes. I wouldn't mind doing that. I know most people would. But however, so 300 minutes or more per week, for example, will lead to weight loss. Decreasing your caloric intake by about 500 calories per day can lead to weight loss. And the combination of both, and I've done some research on that, is it additive, so it would be very helpful. I mean, that's intuitive, but it's additive. So we know those things, and they seem very basic, but those are the tried and true things.
But that's input-output, right?
Exactly. Energy balance, and you're trying to change that energy balance.
And I think that was one of the takeaway messages from the article, is that clearly we need to focus on the input-output issue. But when we get into the minutiae of some of these smaller recommendations, I think what the authors are trying to tell us is we don't have conclusive evidence that some of these things really make a difference. But when we think about the clinical management of this, so when we become clinicians and we're in practice with patients, you know, we've got a toolbox full of strategies, and sometimes these recommendations make a great deal of sense. So, for example, the one about eating breakfast. I'll tell patients it's important to eat small meals throughout the day, in part because I don't want somebody, particularly if they've got an inappropriate emotional connection to food, to go home and overeat at night. Mm-hmm. So by moving more calories up in the day, they're not starving when they get home. They're not nibbling and then having dinner and then nibbling again while watching American Idol. So is there a good scientific evidence that says this is why I'm making that recommendation? Not necessarily, but I also may be thinking about the patient as a whole when I do make that recommendation.
Well, one of the myths that they write about, and I'm just quoting here, National Health Guidelines and reputable websites advertise that large changes in weight accumulation indefinitely after small sustained daily lifestyle modifications. I didn't do that very well. Small sustained changes in energy intake or expenditure will produce large long-term weight gains. The idea that if, and quoting here, if you ate, you know, an extra cookie a day, that then you would, you know, over time you would gain weight. It's saying maybe not so fast. And I remember having someone say that on the air thinking, oh my gosh, you know, if something so small and incremental can change someone's weight, that almost didn't make sense.
Right.
Well, if I can, yes, go to that point, Marty, actually, it may not result in large weight loss, but what it will do, and as researchers, we actually will write grants to say we're trying to prevent weight gain.
Right.
So those types of changes may prevent weight gain, and they're small ways to tell people, you know what? Here are the small ways. I often tell people, if you drink regular soda every day and you can at least cut that out, if you make no other changes, you're going to help yourself from gaining weight. Mm-hmm. And perhaps you might even lose 5 pounds, which is the better direction to be going.
Well, and it also raises questions about having a reasonable goal to lose weight. I mean, it seems to me that, but doesn't it make sense to say, you know, I'd like to lose 25 pounds and let me see what I can do to do that?
So this is another one that I really struggled with because, you know, it's straddling the line between practicing scientifically or evidence-based medicine versus how do we motivate and encourage our patients to do things. So we know that in studies that have been done that show that almost everybody who comes in for weight loss, regardless of the strategy, wants to lose more weight than is realistically attainable, whether we're talking about behavioral modification or pharmacotherapy or even bariatric surgery. So bariatric surgery, people lose about a third of their weight, but everybody wants to lose 50%.
Oh, that's interesting. Because we do have some unrealistic expectations.
And what we'll try to do is to educate patients about what's realistic. Because I get concerned, and maybe this is the mental health professional in me coming out, that if a patient is expecting a 50% weight loss and they only lose a third, third's incredibly impressive, but they're going to throw the baby out with the bathwater and they're going to focus on being discouraged and not losing half their body weight, not realizing it was unrealistic in the first place.
Yeah.
So patients will sometimes, you know, say, why are you discouraging me? And I say, I'm not so much discouraging you as I'm trying to practice evidence-based medicine and differentiate what I'm telling you from the snake oil salesman in the world, because unfortunately there's a tremendous amount of snake oil sales that go on when we talk about the weight loss industry.
Well, and I'm thinking of all those, you know, book titles, all those ads you see on TV. I mean, that must drive you crazy, Stella.
Oh, my quote usually is, I don't read a mechanical engineering book and call myself a mechanical engineer. So people read nutrition and exercise stuff and they say, oh, well, I know about this. So it does a little bit, Marty, but I've become more calm over the years. But I want to, again, sort of parlay off of something David said, because it's something that I think does not get out there very often is, you don't need to lose a lot of weight for that weight to result in healthy, what we call metabolic changes. So a really famous trial called the Diabetes Prevention Program trial, DPPT. What they did was they had a group of people who were given the metformin, the medication, and a group who had intensive lifestyle changes, diet and exercise. And they found that they both did well, but the lifestyle change group did even better. Hmm. A greater percentage lost weight, but more importantly, the weight that they lost was about 5 to 7%, and that resulted in them not getting diabetes or coming off medication if they had been on it, which to me is far more impressive than looking like an airbrushed model.
Yeah.
Well, and you're saying even someone that, let's say, was 100 pounds overweight or someone that was 50 pounds, that if they lost 5 or 6% of that, they were in better shape.
They were definitely in better shape. I mean, they still have some way to go, but they definitely were in better shape than if, you know, they they didn't have to lose that 100 pounds to sort of improve a little bit.
Right. And in addition to the DPP, there are other studies that have shown that a 5% weight loss is what we call a clinically significant weight loss, that we see improvements in hypertension, in diabetes status, and so forth. So while it may not be aesthetically sexy for the patient, and the patient obviously wants to lose more, in part because one of their motivations to be there is to improve their appearance, we really try to ground them in the fact that our objective in helping you lose and control your weight is to improve your health first and foremost. If we get you to the point where you're really thrilled about the changes in your appearance, better still. But the first goal has to do with improving your health.
But is it hard to study why people lose weight or gain weight? I mean, is that a hard issue to study still?
It is a very difficult issue to study because, and David, being a psychologist, knows this better than I, is that there are so many issues, especially when people become morbidly obese or even 50 to 70 pounds obese. And oftentimes they'll say to me, well, you don't know how I must feel. And so there are many issues involved. And I will tell you, although there's can be a genetic component for when I bring them into my lab, for example, and test their metabolic rate, which is the energy they need just to stay alive, most people are within the normal range. Oh. So people want to say to me, oh, it must be my metabolism.
It's broken.
Yeah, it's broken. And you wish that it were. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you, for the most part, maybe 2% of as you, David, have a lower than normal metabolic rate.
So you're saying people are eating too much?
Eating too much.
Or not moving enough.
And not moving enough. And I really, that's a big issue. People are not moving enough. And even, I'll tell my students, even things where TV is sedentary, but when we were growing up in this studio here, we didn't have a channel changer. I was the channel changer. So even
you had to get up and change the channel.
So even sedentary behaviors have become more sedentary over the years.
Well, yeah. I would think too, David, as a professor of psychology and psychiatry, I mean, food is so laden with meanings and emotion and family and history. And I mean, I would assume that's also what makes this a complicated issue.
Yeah, and you said that beautifully. And one of the things that we'll tell our patients is, you know, so many of our cultural rituals are tied to food. So, you know, when we're celebrating a birth, when we're grieving a death, when we're thinking about our major holidays, when we go to things like weddings, the second question after how did the bride look is, how was the food?
Exactly.
And so it's so much a fundamental part of our culture. And then lay probably more underneath that, just the readily available nature of food in our society today and how it's really to the point where we go just about anywhere, food's available to us. And so while we're dealing with our busy, hectic lives, we're engaging in what's called mindless eating. So we're putting in those extra 300 to 500 calories a day, not giving it a second thought. And the next thing we know, we're in our primary care physician's office at our annual physical, and they're telling us, you know, we've gained 10 or 15 pounds in the last year or two, and we kind of look at ourselves in the mirror and say, how did that happen?
Yeah, well, snacks and channel changers. I hear you saying that. Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about how to separate fact from fiction when it comes to weight loss and weight gain. And our guests are Stella Volpe. She's a nutritionist, exercise physiologist, professor, and chair in the Department of Nutrition Sciences at Drexel University. Also with us, David Sarwar. He's a professor of psychology and psychiatry and surgery at the Perelman School of Music, Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Yes, playing the violin here. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Abington Health supports WHYY and offers new techniques designed to help people with heart failure, AFib, and chest pain to get back to their normal routine. To learn more about the heart team performing new treatments and to view patient stories, abingtonpowertoheal.org.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. 52 years ago, the Philadelphia chromosome was discovered in a Fox Chase laboratory. The Philadelphia chromosome was the first specific genetic abnormality linked to a specific cancer. Fast forward to today, and Fox Chase is offering a new diagnostic test for advanced cancers. Through next-generation DNA sequencing, tumor-specific genetic abnormalities now can be matched to precision drugs. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
It's an NPR News special, live coverage of President Obama's State of the Union address. I'm Melissa Blogg. Join me for in-depth analysis and reaction from members of Congress. You'll also hear the Republicans' response to the president's speech. It's an NPR News special, President Obama's State of the Union address.
tonight at 9 on WHYY-TV, online at WHYY.org, and right here on WHYY-FM.
The Oriental Rug Room at 10,000 Villages in Ephrata supports WHYY, now hosting their annual rug event, featuring the Fairtrade Bunyad Rug Collection of over 1,500 hand-knotted rugs. Online at rugs.10,000villages.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow, and talking with Stella Volpe and David Sauer about how to separate fact from fiction when it comes to weight gain, weight loss, diets, things like that. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Even going back to this New England Journal of Medicine article, they raised questions about PE, physical education, and whether that or doesn't help prevent childhood obesity. And I was sort of scratching my head thinking, if it's important to move and moving burns calories, why wouldn't that be good advice to give somebody?
And I don't think it's not that it's good advice. I think what the article is saying, again, is this notion that there hasn't been a well-controlled clinical randomized controlled trial, which is the gold standard of how we do scientific and medically based research, which would compare a school that has regular PE versus another set of school or schools that don't have regular PE, and then track those children over time. And while I think it's an ambitious goal to say, mm-hmm. boy, it'd be great to do that study, sometimes randomized controlled trials, and I'd love to talk evidence-based medicine, are somewhat impossible to do. And to really do the definitive study in that area would take years, if not decades, and millions, if not multi-millions of dollars to pull off. And yet, at the same time, would we really have that much greater insight that would then dictate policy? I'm not so sure about that. Whereas I think Stella and I would agree, the better thing is, let's get our kids moving.
Sure. I mean, it seems to me that's kind of common sense, which is if there's PE or gym or regular activity for children in school, they may not lose dramatic amounts of weight, but that's got to be good for their health.
Definitely good for their health. I mean, we know, research has shown us that, you don't have to lose a lot of weight to be healthy. And then I was a part of a multi-center study, actually, with the principal investigator, Dr. Gary Foster from Temple University. And we did change PE within the schools because basically, I think what's happening now is PE, the kids are not moving. Mm-hmm. I think, David, you alluded to that earlier. They're not moving as much.
What are they doing then?
So a lot of times they're maybe standing there, or the teacher has to deal with a lot of discipline issues. So we worked hard so that we could change it so that kids actually were exercising for half, at least 50% of the time or more, and got their heart rates up to about 135 beats per minute. But a lot of times you go to a PE class, mm-hmm. half of them might be standing around.
You were on the President's Council on Fitness, Sports, and Nutrition Science. What are you grappling with on this board?
Well, with this board, we grapple with a lot of things. We try to work hard to ensure that what gets out there about exercise and nutrition is is a proper message that gets out there. So we have a research digest journal that many of us publish in to try to get the right messages out.
Anything you want to add to that? I do want to get to our callers. Just in terms of, you know, I mean, we've got Michelle Obama, the First Lady, talking about exercise, eating healthy, a good message.
Yeah. And I also think, getting back to the article and you know, even position statements that come from, you know, government agencies and the White House and the First Lady, I think we would all probably agree that there at times is too much information out there. And as a result, you know, kind of like we often say about the internet, that there's a lot of good out there and a lot of interesting stuff, and then there's a lot of garbage. And again, the weight loss industry and the kind of how do we help people lose weight, it's sometimes hard to separate the good quality science and the reasoned recommendations from the garbage that's out there. And there's a long-standing history of that in the weight loss industry.
But it also sounds like there's the minutia, you know, which is looking at tiny sort of aspects of our lifestyle or our eating habits.
Right. And when we think about, again, from the societal and the environmental perspective, I do think we just need to stay on this drumbeat of, we need to eat less, exercise more, eat less, be mindful of what we're eating, and be as physically active as we can be. As I'll sometimes say to patients, it's a little bit like George Costanza in Seinfeld. You want to do the opposite of what everybody else in society is doing. So if everybody's waiting to get on an escalator, take the staircase right next to it, because that's an opportunity to get some steps in that you otherwise were missing in your day because of the way our society and culture's evolved.
Let me get to, it looks like Christina from Morristown, New Jersey, to join us on Radio Times. And Christina, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
You had spoken about eating 500 calories less a day and getting the 300 minutes a week in. How about someone who's like, they have like hypothyroidism? How much more energy do they have to expend to be able to like get some sort of weight loss going? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Christina, thanks for the call. And go ahead, Stella.
Hey, Christina, thank you. It does get a little more difficult when, you know, you are one of those 1 to 2% of the people who do have a slower metabolic rate than the average person. So I would still say that I would recommend the same amount of exercise to you and to decrease your caloric intake slightly, but to ensure, too, that if you are on medication from your physician, that you continue to take that on a regular basis. And the other thing to check out that some people don't often get checked out is their iron levels, because iron and actually zinc are both related to the conversion of your more active form of your thyroid. So if you haven't gotten that checked, I would also check that out.
Anything you want to add to that?
No, I think it's a great point. The other thing that comes to mind is I have a colleague in the Department of Psychiatry at Penn who oftentimes realizes that there's an overlap between hypothyroidism and mood issues, and that sometimes by helping somebody go on an antidepressant medication can also improve, or adjusting their thyroid medication can sometimes have the dual effect in both treating their thyroid condition as well as their mood. So there's definitely that relationship that needs to be considered as well.
Let me go back to this New England Journal of Medicine article, David, and one of the things that they write here is that breastfeeding doesn't necessarily protect against obesity, I guess obesity in children. I don't know about the mom or not, but I mean, I always thought that was a good thing. I mean, there are many good reasons to do that.
And
I don't know if...
And that's not an area where I do most of my research, but I was struck by that too, because I think I was, like a lot of people, in assuming that the evidence there was actually much more conclusive. And I think, as they make the point in the article, that there's also seems to be a pretty strong, for lack of a better term, advocacy group of professionals who have beaten that drum pretty hard and really want us to believe that. And perhaps they've done that independent of the scientific evidence behind them.
But it's probably still a good thing to breastfeed your child.
I'm not aware of any evidence that says that it's not.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think, Stella?
No, it definitely is. But it's the behavior, too, of again, we have a faculty member in my department, Dr. Allison Ventura, who studies feeding behavior, and that's important. So the breastfeeding is important, but also the mother's attitudes and behaviors to ensure that the child is not being overfed.
Mm-hmm. But it seems to me that also taps into wanting this quick fix, right? I mean, if there's just this little, you know, magic wand you can wave in the air, and you know, then you can deal with this issue.
Yeah, I mean, that you mean as far as with the breastfeeding,
or just generally speaking about weight loss.
Oh my goodness, people!
Like, if only
if people would just want to take a pill, and that would be the easiest thing. Right. And I will often tell my participants that it didn't take you 3 weeks to get here. So it's not going to take you 3 weeks to lose it.
Yeah, and then we see that same problem, too, when we think about people coming for bariatric surgery. So they'll say, they will make the assumption that the surgical intervention, regardless of which one it is going to do all the work, when in fact the surgical intervention is a tool, and it's a tool that needs to be used correctly like any other tool. And so I'll draw the analogy with patients saying, you know, if you bring a contractor into your home and they don't use their equipment the right way, your kitchen's not going to look the way you want it to. This is a tool like a carpenter's equipment, and if you don't use these tools the right way, if you use the wrong end of the hammer when we think about bariatric surgery and you're not making the dietary and behavioral changes, you're not going to be as successful as you want to be, and in some cases have some pretty nasty complications.
You had mentioned early in the hour, Stella, about portion control, and I just want to give you a chance to expand on that, only because it's just so obvious that you know, plates are so much bigger than they were when I was coming up, for instance.
Yes, and portion control, we know what one of the facts we know is that decreasing your portions can lead to weight loss. And a study that I conducted, we did this in the university cafeteria, and we had one dining hall where we changed the portion sizes and another that we did not, and we effectively prevented weight gain in freshmen.
Really?
So it was a clinical significance. It was not a statistical significance, as David alluded to earlier. However, this, and we did no other education. The students were unaware of these changes. So the good news was they had an all-you-can-eat area that they were able to choose, and the foods, and they ended up actually preventing we prevented their weight gain.
Mm-hmm. And was it a dramatic difference in the size of the portions?
The difference was about 20%. So I wouldn't say dramatic, because we had to deal with the food service workers who were used to cutting things a certain way for thousands of students, but enough that, you know, only 20%, and that's what I often try to tell people. I put it in sort of terms of looks, but 20% is not a lot, really.
Yeah.
And we also know from other studies that we are more responsive to the size of the portion or the size of the container than our internal cues of hunger. So, for example, if we had a bowl of M&Ms here in front of us and we were able to nibble on them while we're on the show today, we would just continue to eat until potentially they're gone, unless we're practicing a good deal of restraint and saying, I'm just not going to have any of these at all. Same thing when we order we go out to restaurants, we order fast food, we typically stop when we're done with what's in front of us, not because our stomach or some signal in our brain is telling us that we're full. And so I think that's where we as consumers and eaters need to be mindful that the food culture and the food industry in our society makes their money by giving us large amounts of food. And again, we need to do something a little bit different in terms of practice some restraint in terms of how much we actually eat.
Go to a movie theater and order a small soda.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's,
right.
It's a foot high.
It's not a small soda.
It's not a small soda.
Thank you for saying that. Yeah. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. We're talking with Stella Volpe. She's a professor chair of the Department of Nutrition Science at Drexel University. She serves on the President's Council on Fitness, Sports, and Nutrition Science Board. And she's also a nutritionist and an exercise physiologist. David Sarwar. Did I do that right?
Third time's a charm.
Sarwar. Thank you. David Sarwar, professor of psychology and psychiatry and surgery at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. There was another, debunked myth in this article that somehow if you have sex, or I guess vigorous sex, that's good for weight loss. True, not true.
Again, I think the commentary from David Allison, who was a senior author on that paper, really kind of said it all. In that it doesn't pass the sniff test in terms of how would you actually do the study to, you really probably couldn't do that study in this day and age. And I do think that's one of those urban legends that's just always gotten out there. But I will say, we've had patients when we ask them in our clinical trials and our clinical practices, what are they doing for lifestyle activity? They will kind of offer up, well, does, being intimate count?
Sure.
And we'll say, well, it's better than not moving at all.
But actually, I have to say, one of the findings in here is that the average time for sexual activity was 6 minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not exactly a marathon.
No, it's not.
Stella, anything you want to add to that?
I'm glad he took that question. That's all, Marty. I'm glad you looked to him.
you don't want to touch this thing.
No, but the one thing David alluded to again, the taking the stairs, and research
very
is showing
good segue,
us, which
by
is
the way.
A, thank you very much. Am I turning red?
No.
So the other thing is that we're also learning that people who exercise daily and then when they sit the rest of the day are at risk for even having blood sugars go a little higher. So the idea too is making sure you're as active during the day as you possibly can. Take the stairs, sit on a balance ball at your desk, get up every few minutes. Those kinds of things all add up, and they're very important to prevent things like diabetes, not so much obesity if you exercise daily.
And I really think what Stella just said is really important when we think about this article, which is those things add up. Whereas I think the article is telling us that any of these behaviors or any of these strategies in isolation may not have a dramatic effect. But in fact, if you're doing this, and this, that those small changes sustained over time can improve your weight and your health. And I think I'm hoping is one of the take-home messages for your listeners. And one of the things that I've been concerned about with this article, that people are throwing the proverbial baby out with the bathwater and saying, well, I don't need to do any of this stuff.
Well, and one of the other, they didn't call it a myth exactly, but they're just saying we haven't really studied the impact of parks and sidewalks on obesity or weight gain. But again, if people are walking, and I think even in New York City, that the rate of obesity is lower there because people are walking.
People are walking. There actually is good research on the built environment. Good research on physical activity increases rather than the obesity epidemic. So, you know, again, what I like that these authors did is that they got us thinking. They got researchers thinking. What I think David said is, too, what we worry about is we don't want the public to say, well, yeah, okay, then I guess this doesn't really matter anymore if I take the stairs, if I, you know, walk my dog longer or do something more each day. That's something both of us would not want people to take away from this.
Yeah, and you know, when articles like this post, I'll sometimes go, and I know it's a dangerous practice, to the comment section, you know, below and see what people are saying. And because I do think it allows me to take the temperature of what people are thinking about these. And there was a fair amount of dismissiveness of, all right, well, I don't need to do any of this stuff, or here's more egghead scientists confusing me even more. And that's, again, my concern with this article, is that it really could be could be seen as very confusing, if not contradictory, to some people who don't appreciate some of the nuances and rigor of things like randomized controlled trials.
And going back to something we touched on earlier, which is also how the press then reports on something like this. And again, if it's distilled down to a headline, you know, is it really helping to educate people?
And that's my worry, too, which is it's not. And it just adds to the drumbeat of confusion. And then as a result, people can throw up their hands and say, well, now I'm just really confused. I don't know what to do. So as a result, it's, I'm not going to do anything. Right. And that my weight is beyond my control. And that's something I think Stahl and I would agree on is definitely not the case, that making behavioral and lifestyle changes is something that really allows people to control their weight or be more successful at controlling their weight.
But it's hard. I mean, it seems to me that it's hard to lose weight. As you both said, you know, we're surrounded by food all the time. Many of us live much more sedentary lifestyles than our parents or grandparents or certainly our ancestors. And, you know, it seems that we have a culture and a country that sort of supports a sedentary lifestyle.
We do, and it's very
easy. And lots of eating and
lots of mindless eating, and then the choices. So it's not only the quantity, but it's the quality of the food available that's very fast and easy to get. And that's something that I think oftentimes people do not pay attention to.
Yeah, one of the things just related to that I'm also gets my attention from time to time is my senior colleagues, Mickey Stunkard and Tom Wadden, you know, are trained as mental health professionals, have worked their entire careers to really teach us that obesity is not a psychiatric issue, and that it's been within the last decade that we've made this sense of, no, obesity is a recognized medical condition associated with other pretty scary medical conditions like hypertension and diabetes. And at the same time, we now have a current that's bringing us a little bit back around, where not in that article, where we've got some people who are now saying, well, obesity is really a form of an addiction. Mm-hmm. And that people are addicted to food, and that they're eating because of this, that, or the other, you know, brain abnormality or neurochemical changes, no different than people who abuse cocaine or alcohol. And what I worry about as a mental health professional is that we've now come full circle, that after decades of working really hard to help people realize that our food is a big contributor in terms of why people are obese, we now have a bit of a sea change coming back around to saying, but maybe it's an addiction. Mm. So maybe it is a psychiatric illness. And that's where I get a little confused and concerned.
Well, because if it's, and we're almost up on a break here, if it's an addiction, that requires a different kind of response, right?
Absolutely.
Or treatment.
And you know, I that's probably beyond our scope, particularly given our time limitations right now. But I just worry that that's ultimately not very helpful for patients. And instead, we try to not blame patients and put more of the focus on the environment.
Well, we are talking about what we know and don't know about weight loss and weight gain. David Sarwer and Stella Volpe, our guests. And just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Widener University supports WHYY. Widener University offers degrees in programs including hospitality and tourism, human sexuality, physical therapy, social work, clinical psychology, criminal justice, nursing, and more. A Widener education is designed to help students gain substantive leadership experience to help put them at an advantage. Details on graduate degree programs online at widener.edu. Widener University. Widener Leadership Works.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We've been raising money during the winter membership campaign here at WHYY, and we still have some work to do. Our thanks to everyone who made a pledge, but if you didn't, there's still time to do it. We rely on listeners just like you to fund the programs that you enjoy and turn to stay informed. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499, or you can pledge at WHYY.org. You'll be glad you did, and so will we. Thanks very much.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Ahead of the President's State of the Union address, job growth, a huge challenge. What's the view like for employers and workers? Also, from a jam session in a dorm room with John Mayer to fronting her own band, fiddler Carrie Rodriguez. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Motz-Cohane talking with Stella Volpe. She's professor and chair of the Department of Nutrition Science at Drexel University. She serves on the board of the President's Council on Fitness, Sports, and Nutrition Science. David Sarwar is a professor of psychology in psychiatry and surgery at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. And we invited them both here to get their reaction to a recent issue of the New England Journal of Medicine talking about fact and fiction when it comes to weight loss and weight gain. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Shannon from, looks like LaSalle University to join us. Shannon, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
Such an important topic.
Thanks.
I'm actually teaching a math content class this semester at LaSalle. And I'm just wondering if you are aware of some of the books that are put out by Scholastic, that are looking at Hershey's, teaching fractions using Hershey's bars, teaching adding using M&Ms, teaching probability using Skittles. And I'm actually having my students rewrite these books using healthy options because I think our teachers are sometimes giving out a lot of treats for learning different things and not really realizing kind of that what it might be sending a message to our students.
So substituting a carrot for a Hershey bar, Shannon?
Exactly. Yeah. Actually, like what I'm going to do is redo Mandarin oranges for fractions or oranges for fractions. I've done this also at Portland State University where my students started using popcorn, healthy popcorn with not, you know, they'd go, oh, look, it doesn't have a lot of butter on it and salt and it's healthier option. And just kind of helping teachers rethink what they're giving their students.
No, I think it's a great point. Let me give David Sarwar a chance to respond.
Yeah, Shannon, I'm really impressed by your thoughtfulness with that because I think you're onto something there. That even though it may seem to some people pretty, you know, well, what's the big deal? The reality is that there's a little bit of subtle messaging going on there. And again, while it may not have been studied in a randomized controlled trial, it's hard not to imagine that something like that might not have a subtle impact on a small number of kids who are in the room. And you know, my son is 10 years old right now. When I visit him at his school, I'm always struck by how the cultural influence in the school is so very different than it was when I was in elementary school, and very much for the better.
Mm-hmm.
Now, do we know that the posters that say don't bully other kids are helping? Sometimes we think that evidence is true. Sometimes we don't know. But it's hard to imagine that it would hurt. So when we think about using Mandarin oranges instead of Hershey bars to teach fractions, I can't see how there'd be anything wrong with that.
I absolutely agree.
Well, and I'm thinking of schools that have taken out soda machines and things like that. I mean, that makes sense, doesn't it?
Makes a lot of sense. Philadelphia was one of the first schools to actually do that and put water in their vending machines. And it makes a difference because if that's what you see, especially 6 hours a day when you're, you know, there at school, at least that might make a difference overall in the choices you make later.
Mm-hmm. Shannon, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And you can call as well. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. David, we ran across something that I guess looks like you wrote for the Huffington Post. Bonnie Image researcher David Sarwar debunks Hollywood myths. Myth one, the fatter you are, the worse your body image. And you were sort of doing to a body image, I guess, what the New England Journal of Medicine was doing to some of these.
And as much as I would love to blog for the Huffington Post, I think I was just interviewed for that story back in the fall. But
okay. But
we do know that as people gain weight, it can have a negative effect on their body image. But at the same time, it's important to realize that there's a disconnect between how we objectively look to others and how we see ourselves in our own mind. And so we often don't perceive ourselves physically the same way that other people see us. And so oftentimes we'll see with people who are even of an average or normal body weight, they'll show a great amount of distress about, you know, I'm a little heavier than I want to be, my hips and thighs aren't the size that I'd like them to be. And it can, and the magnitude of distress can actually be out of line with how big their hips and thighs really are. And so while we know as people get heavier, they typically show more distress, there's also a tremendous amount of individual difference there as well.
Because that's the, I mean, part of this whole eating thing is about body image. And do people, if they distort themselves, the way they look, do they distort them in a negative way, that they tend to see themselves as less attractive than others too?
It's interesting. I think it's a part of the American phenomena that we tend to be critical of our appearance. You know, we see very few people walk around in society and say, I look great in these jeans.
but, I hate those people.
But at the same, everybody seems to.
Exactly.
But I also think that sometimes, particularly when we think about extreme obesity, that some of our patients simply don't realize they're as heavy as they really are. And as a result, they're not necessarily seeking treatment. So they may say, oh, I'm just a little quote-unquote chunky, and not realize that if we start looking at their body mass index and their relationship with comorbidities, they're actually clinically obese, if not extremely obese, and are likely at risk for a whole host of major health problems. And so they see it as an aesthetic issue, whereas we would see it more as a medical risk issue.
I don't know, Stella, if you've looked at these food deserts as they are described as certain parts of the country, sometimes in cities, but I think it's probably also true in other parts of the country where there isn't a grocery store. If you can find fresh fruits and vegetables, they probably don't look that great. How serious a problem is that, do you think?
It's actually a very serious problem. And in particular, in cities, including Philadelphia, unfortunately, where you go to places, particularly of lower income, not only are there no appropriate food supermarkets there, but what is available is absolutely terrible. The quality of food, the quality of the produce. And so therefore, what will people get? They will go to the items that are packaged, that are, you know, higher in fat, higher in salt, because it's easier, because it looks better, and it appears to be cheaper. Actually, it really isn't, but it appears to be cheaper. And so all that will lead to increased caloric intake, which will increase weight gain. And that's sort of phenomenon of how is it that people of lower income typically have greater obesity, but it's partly due to these food deserts.
And this packaged food tends to be heavy in things like sugar, fat, and salt. And you know, our taste buds love that stuff.
The three big ones, sugar, fat, and salt, which is what brings people back always a lot of times to these fast food restaurants. And, you know, I tell people, give yourself a couple of weeks, even with salt, or change things just a little bit, even though this article would disagree.
Yeah.
And in a couple of weeks, you will feel that, you know, you don't really need that much salt anymore.
Yeah, I really want to echo that point, because we see that clinically all the time with patients. And when we transition them to healthier diets and we encourage them to reduce their fat intake, they do tell us that they often experience a change in their taste, and they don't feel like compelled to go back to McDonald's for lunch every day, and they realize there's a wider variety of foods out there.
And because there is that sort of nauseous, at least I get, you know, my once a year trip to McDonald's for a fish sandwich, afterwards
And our patients who, you know, in our studies will, and I think Stella's as well, we often put them on try to reduce their calories by about 500 calories a day, but eat a well-balanced diet. But it tends to be on the end of lower fat. And so if somebody deviates from that 6 weeks later and they go to McDonald's or they go get a cheesesteak, they'll sometimes come in and say, boy, I really felt that. I really didn't feel very good after I ate that. And we kind of use that as a teachable moment to say, well, you know, that's your body telling you this isn't the healthiest food for you.
Should we change the word diet? Because I think diet is associated with things like deprivation or no, you can't have that.
I always like to say lifestyle change. And people, when I talk to my participants or a weight management program we have at Drexel, you know, we'll tell them, we're not telling you to not eat certain things, but look at the portion sizes and enjoy what you do eat. So I often will say, have that real cookie, just don't have five of them.
Yes.
And enjoy it. Because I think part of what we haven't really talked about today is that people aren't enjoying food as much. You know, growing up Italian from Italian immigrants, boy, we got everything from the garden, everything homemade. And all of that was, we enjoyed eating. We didn't overeat, but we enjoyed it. And I think a lot of people are eating on the run. They're eating in front of their computers. A lot of these things that again, mindless eating that people don't even realize that they've eaten.
Yeah, I think that's an exceptionally good point, that we have gotten away from really enjoying food and sitting down, whether it's, you know, sitting down at our desk and really enjoying what's in front of us, or taking the time, you know, with our families on the weekends to really sit down and enjoy a healthily prepared meal. And as a result, I think when we're eating quickly and we're engaged, you know, we're on the internet or doing whatever while we're eating, we're not giving our bodies a chance to say, I don't need the rest of this. So clinically, what I'll say to patients is, you know, if you, like you said, Stella, you know, enjoy a cookie. Don't eat the, you know, go and get a cookie that you really enjoy, but make sure you really take the time to enjoy it. If you're going to snarf it down in two bites, it probably wasn't worth it. You would have been better off having an apple.
And the mindless part of it is that if you're on the computer or doing something else, you're actually not paying attention to what you're eating,
yeah,
or even maybe even tasting what it tastes like.
Yeah, exactly.
And that whole 20 minutes for your brain to know that you've eaten, that whole little thing that sounds like a old wives' tale, it's yeah, not. It's true. You need to take that time so your body physiologically knows you've eaten, and therefore you tend yeah to eat less.
And yet I was surprised that wasn't one of the myths that
they
took on.
Yes, yes.
I was too.
I agree with you completely.
Better trademark that very quickly. Yeah. Let me get Marianne from Newtown to join us. And Marianne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I just wanted to know if there's been any research done. You guys touched on the subject of quality of food. So has there been any research done in terms of your body's response to the quality of the nutrition that you take in? So if you take in 1,200 calories in a day of McDonald's versus 1,200 calories a day of fruits and vegetables and legumes or something, does your body have a different response to the latter?
That's an interesting question, Marianne. Let me toss that to Stella Volpe.
Thanks, Marianne. That's a great question, and actually one that I was hoping would be asked, because overall, when you look at total calories in, total calories out, really, I hate to say this, and I don't want people to take this like, oh, I can eat anything. It doesn't really matter when it comes to caloric intake. However, the quality of the food is extremely important to your health. So, I don't know, about 2 years ago, there was a professor in Missouri who actually did a quick study on himself. He ate like Twinkies and all these things in the day, decreased his caloric intake, lost a bunch of weight. Mm-hmm. This was not a randomized controlled trial, mind you. And but he wasn't trying to profess that. What he's trying to say was, yeah, I can lose weight this way, but really what we need to do is not only change the caloric intake, but change the quality of the food. Have there been a lot of studies, to your question, Marianne, on the quality? Not as much on the quality, but we do know from epidemiological research that greater fruits and vegetables, whole grains, et cetera, can prevent us from getting cancer, heart disease, et cetera.
But you're saying in terms of just eating a calorie is a calorie is a calorie?
Yes. Some will disagree with me. Okay. There are people out there who would disagree with me, but really it is. A calorie is a calorie in the sense of, now how much quickly we can metabolize, say, fat versus carbohydrates. Carbohydrates and protein get metabolized more quickly. But if I'm going to, quote-unquote, diet, even though we don't want to use that word, I could probably just, if I decrease my calories, but the quality is really, really important to overall health and lifestyle change.
But I just want to reinforce what you just said, but in terms of how our body metabolizes, it metabolizes carbohydrates in a different kind of way?
Well, yes. All three, protein, fat, and carbohydrates, get metabolized differently, and fat will be sort of a little bit more slowly metabolized and held on to a little bit more. But really, 1,200 in, whether I have it from great food or not great food, I'm still probably going to lose weight if I have decreased my intake.
You thinking about that, David?
Oh, no,
What message is there?
No, I'm absolutely in agreement with it, and I'm actually find myself thinking about, you know, some of the infomercials and other books that we say that really kind of advocate some really, oh, if not strange, then definitely atypical approaches to what you should and should not eat. And again, I think that's where gets back to my point about snake oil salesmen, that unfortunately the weight loss industry has its fair share of that, that people, everybody's an expert, everybody can write a book, everybody thinks they know what they're doing, and a lot of those things aren't necessarily evidence-based. And that, I think, also gets back to really our message today about and the importance of that paper in the New England Journal, that while we need to be scientific and rigorous in our approach to this, we also need to make sure that we're communicating clearly to patients about what is valid, what works, and that small changes really do make a difference.
And binge dieting or yo-yo dieting, where do you stand on something how do you understand that?
Yeah, so we actually wrote a paper on that about 15 years ago, right, when I got to Penn, and that actually reviewed the literature and said that the evidence wasn't as compelling as people feared in terms of the adverse effects. But from a psychological perspective, we always worry about people being demoralized, which is that, you know, you lose weight and you're successful and then you regain. And then does that keep you from engaging in healthier behaviors in the future?
Let me see if I can squeeze Chris from Egg Harbor to join us. And Chris, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Love your show.
Thanks.
I wanted to share with you and your guests my recent experience. Back in May, I'm 47 years old. I'm a little over 6 foot.
And Chris, I got to jump in here only because we have about 30 seconds. Go ahead.
Sure. Okay. So what I did was, since I was getting over 240 pounds, gaining weight year after year, I decided it was time to lose weight. I went on a structured, high-protein, low-carbohydrate diet that had to be administered by a medical professional. You can't just go out and do this. I lost considerable weight. I went from 241 down to 288. Lost the lion's share of that weight on that protein diet, but what I've done since is basically keep some of those concepts. But most importantly, just be mindful about everything that I'm putting in my mouth. And that's really the most important thing now, keeping the weight off. It's been 8 months. And I wanted to get your guest's opinion on using those types of diets.
And I'm interrupting you only because I don't know. We hear you. And we're talking about this high-protein, low-carb diet.
Well, you know, it's good that you did this under medical supervision. I think that, you know, there's definitely varying evidence about high protein versus lower fat intake. However, you do want to be careful as time goes on that you get a good balance of carbohydrates, proteins, fats, and being mindful of your eating is obviously important, and certainly making sure that you keep an exercise program with that, because lifestyle change and good behavioral lifestyle change, not that you have to eat the same thing every day, is very, very important.
Chris, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Stella Volpe and David Sarwar, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. David Sarwar, professor of psychology and psychiatry and surgery at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania. Stella Volpe, professor and chair of the Department of Nutrition Science at Drexel University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to learn more about the program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Katie Ricciardi is our intern this semester. Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder produce Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.